You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 11th of October 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live today at RadioAryan.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, Communism by the Back Door and the Freemasonic victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good evening to you. How are you doing?
Good evening. And still, we haven't finished the sources on the Masonic victory. It's like pulling teeth for me, this really is.
How long have you been on it now, then?
Oh, I don't know. I just don't get inspired by rooting around for lost sources.
Maybe, maybe in the future you should do it. Maybe in the future you should do it but at the end of each episode or something. So that you don't have to do it at the end.
I agree. I said a couple of weeks ago, didn't I? People like David Irving are more organised than myself.
Well, at least you've got the documentary done anyway. Is there going to be any more to it besides the sources?
I mean, I've got the clip of John Emery, who's talking in Norway, and he's been questioned whether or not he was a traitor or not, and he said, well, this is going to decide this. I think that it's Churchill and Roosevelt who are the traitors to Europe, traitors to humanity, and traitors to Christianity. And that's another clue to what the World War II was on about, because even John Emery said it.
Maybe
he should know his father's in the cabinet.
Yeah. His father was actually in the cabinet fighting on the side of Churchill, was he? Wow!
Exactly. Yeah,
and they still hanged him at the end of the war.
Yes, they did. But to be fair, he stopped the proceedings after two or three minutes and said, "I've had enough. I'm guilty."
Oh, what, the court proceedings?
Yeah, he just. I don't think he wanted to hang around for days on end, so he just called the judge. Said, "I'm guilty." And the judge said to him, "Well, you know what that means." Yes, I understand totally. Treason is the death sentence, and he got the death sentence. And Pierpont hanged him. But I just don't think he wanted to live in a world, because he was so clued up. I mean, for a guy to go and fight abroad when his father's in Churchill's cabinet, he'd obviously know something which a lot of people wouldn't have known.
I wonder if Mr. I might know something about John Amory that hasn't been covered
in
mainstream media.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I'll ask him about that next time.
I'm enjoying them too, by the way. That last one was great, really was.
Yeah.
Like I suggested to you, it should have a special place. People coming onto the site to see and hear somebody, hear somebody who was actually around at that time and telling it like it was. They were brilliant interviews.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I expect most of our listeners have already heard them. But if they haven't, we're referring to Mr. I, a 91-year-old elder nationalist who I've interviewed twice now. Hopefully we're going to interview him again. And obviously he was around at the time that the war took place. So he's got an eyewitness account of it, which is obviously better than reading news reports. So hopefully we'll hear more from him.
Did everything.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. And the village life at the time as well that he was talking about.
Yeah.
How that's changed over the years. So you're going to be talking about John Amory in the final episode. Anything else planned for it?
Yeah, there's a piece also. I managed to get hold of it. I nearly lost it, by the way, but luckily I had my backup on. So I did find it again. Somewhere we went missing and God knows how these things happen. But anyway, I found it, and it's a piece about the ADL and Southern Comfort Law, which is another Jewish organization, in 2016 turned around and said, we are not going to challenge the greatest story never told anymore. We're just going to ignore it because we feel there's still enough people asleep. And if we challenge it, we'll only bring attention to it.
It's rare they actually think that far. Because, whenever they highlight dissidents, the dissidents invariably gain more supporters. because that's basically better than better advertising than you could pay for when they put stuff about you in the mainstream media, and that they're so hysterical about it nowadays, it just acts like an advertisement for us. Like this week, they did a whole piece on far-right women, and it was basically Brittany Pettibone and Lauren Southern. I mean, Lauren Southern's retired now, but just the language in the piece, it was so ridiculous. Every single one of the comments was supporting us and saying, well, where are these people? We want to go and join them. What a ridiculous article this is. How dare you call people far right just because they don't like immigration or they want to leave the EU. And when they do things like that, it's just propaganda for us.
Interestingly enough, Mr. Stephen Molyneux was on BitChute last week begging for donations. His channel on YouTube is still there, but apparently has took quite a lot of, I think it's about 80% down on how he used to survive on it. And he came onto BitChute literally begging for donations. And this is a guy who actually, in an argument against The Greatest Story Never Told, actually said the facts don't matter. I mean, where he gets that from, I do not know. Hang on a sec, just get my headset round. There we go. And so this is a guy now which his work has actually drove people to BitChute, this outer Mongolian island in the middle of nowhere where we've all been pushed onto, and he's on there begging for money. And just as it happened, somebody sent me a video, a little short video, where he's actually admitting that his mother is a Jew who lived in Berlin. And no wonder he only gave The Greatest Story Ever Told 2 minutes, which is another video which he owned up to.
There's so many of these gatekeepers. I mean, we can criticise them for criticising your work, but the thing is, a lot of people will have come to you and to Radio Aryan through Stefan Molyneux first. He would have been one of their first steps on the way. So, you know, they are useful to us. It's interesting to hear that even he is being deplatformed and losing his revenue streams because,
he sounded desperate.
Yeah, well, they never stood up for the people further to the right of him when they lost their revenue streams. I mean, we always have. We've stood up for everyone from the alt-light to the alt-right. You know, anybody that loses their revenue stream and gets deplatformed, you know, that's wrong to take away their ability to speak and take away their ability to earn money. That's terribly wrong. But I would like to see more solidarity on their side when we get deplatformed. But interesting to see that he's lost that much.
Yeah, well, PayPal's. I mean, I think he's down on Wikipedia as a extreme right winger, which I laughed at when I read.
Yeah, that's the thing. They just call everybody now white supremacist, neo-Nazi, and you know, half the time they're people that are against National Socialism. They believe in the Holocaust, and all they've done is say, well, I don't really agree with immigration. And all the while, the mainstream media it calls them all these names. People just see that and they think, well, that means I must be one of these neo-Nazis then. I must be a white supremacist because I agree with what's said there. And, you know, can't beat that, really. That's just really helpful for us, isn't it? Well, on to the subject matters tonight. Obviously, we're going to get into part four of the Nazi Sozi. Hopefully, we're going to finish it tonight because it's, what is it, four weeks now we've been covering this same pamphlet. But before we get into that, I had an email sent in from Mr. Simple, a long-time listener, and he often sends emails in with good questions and comments in there. Sometimes we answer them in a show. Other times we'll just answer him like that. I think I've heard him sending letters into Radio Free Northwest as well, and they answer some of his questions. But I've got four questions from him to begin with from last week that I thought were quite interesting and could spark up a bit of a discussion between us. And his first thing that he says, and I've paraphrased him, his first question: why would the king cede power over money to the Jews in the first place, since the king is sovereign? So what he's saying there is, why would the monarchy put the Jews in charge of money? Why would they allow the Jews to make money in the first place? And I think really you've got to go back and look at, well, why would they have the Jews working for them in the first place? And we never had any Jews in Britain for the first 1,000 years after Christ. If you look at what Alfred the Great had to say about them, he wouldn't have had them in the country, and he was against usury. I think in one bit he talks about them having tails and hooves, so it's obvious that he'd never actually met any of them. But then, obviously, when William the Bastard came in 1066, he brought Jews with him, and the Jews that he brought with him were there as tax collectors, which, you know, that makes sense in a way, because he doesn't want somebody who's going to be sympathizing with the people because he's collecting tax from them. And also, it was a foreign land that he was conquering. It's not like...
Yeah, really castles all over the place, weren't
it? Yeah, well, it's not like he was part of our, you know, our he was part of our race, but he wasn't part of our ethnicity as the British people. He was a Norman. So he wouldn't have wanted British people as tax collectors. He probably wouldn't have wanted Normans as tax collectors. And he brought these Jews in to do the job. And I think then he saw that with the Jews, with their usury, that they make a lot of money with the usury, and where usury is against Christian law, the king could take those profits. So the king would say to the Jews, well, yeah, you can run your banking thing or whatever, and I'll get some of the profits. So I think it was just greed in the first place. And then obviously because of the greed got too much, and the Jews were doing a lot of things that were upsetting the British people, there was allegations of ritual human sacrifice, the king kicked them out. And Edward I, I think it was Edward Longshanks, he kicked them out. And then, as far as we know, they came back in with Cromwell, or not straight away with Cromwell. Who was not a monarch, but Cromwell was funded by these Jews, by these Dutch Jews, and he got rid of the king. And once he got rid of the king, the next king, who was King William of Orange from Holland, when he came in, he brought the Jews back with him, but that was due to this deal that Cromwell had done with them. And once King William had brought these Jews in, he then allowed them to start up the Bank of England and gave them the power over the Bank of England. And then, of course, we got the British Empire, and the British did well out of it, you know, or they brought the money in, basically. Yeah, they brought the money in. And that was due to these Jews and their usury. So I think that was... You know, that was why the king did it, because he thought, well, they have more money, knowledge than I have, and they're going to make more money for me. And they did make more money for Britain. And before that time, they'd been making a lot of money for Holland. So the logic, if you look at what they were writing at the time, what these aristocrats were writing, was, we want to get these Jews over here because look at all the money they've made in Holland. And that's also what the Jews in Holland were saying. Well, let us back into England and we'll make you lots of money like we have over there in Holland. So that would be my answer to that. But I know you've got some other bits that you want to talk about related to
Well, first of all, I found out some information a couple of weeks ago when I looked into it. This 1 mile stretch, the richest 1 mile stretch on earth, which is all the banking and all the financial institutions. This is the city of London. This isn't London. This is a sovereign state within another country. So there's no one can actually tell them what to do. They've got their own police force. They've probably got their own army. And the Queen, when the Queen goes into the City of London, which I think she does once a year, the mayor can come out and greet her in full costume, but she has to dress down. Now, can you imagine this? This is the Queen of England. So consequently, she has to ask permission to enter this 1 mile, and it's a mysterious thing. I mean, in 1066, when the Battle of Hastings took place and the Normans won, that 1 mile was still around. And apparently William the Conqueror did a deal with these people. How they run things is, I think they have a council of 12, and they decide the financial side, and obviously as you know, one of the Rothschild sayings is, give me the purse strings and the finances of a country, I care not who the leader is, because can't do anything without his advice on the money. So, for instance, if England wanted to go to war, and these 12 on this council in the City of London said no when they came to ask for money, then England won't go to war. And so the kind of a power behind the throne, the Prime Minister and Parliament, they're just puppets. The real power is in this one-mile stretch in the City of London. So having said that, yes, the Jews were brought in by William the Conqueror. One of the reasons was he wanted the war in Ireland funding, and they could certainly raise the money and certainly have the money to borrow him or lend him. So he wanted the Jews in. And interestingly enough, yeah, I was watching a programme. We were talking about it before we started, only last night. And it's not a programme that I'd usually watch, but it got quite interesting because this guy who was kind of a TV celebrity, I think he'd been on The Only Way Is Essex or something, he wanted to go back and look for his roots. He'd come from, he thought he was a proper Cockney, but he moved out into Essex. And he also said when he was at school, he felt that he had some Italian. His grandfather, who was still alive, said that he had some Italian or some kind of Mediterranean piece in the blood, like maybe Spain. So he goes back and tries to find his ancestry. And lo and behold, as he's going back, he gets to a point where he finds out he's Jewish, which he never knew. So consequently, he has to go to a couple of synagogues. One of the oldest synagogues in Britain is in that part of London, in Tottenham, that way on. And he found out that the Jews at that time was either Ashkenazi, which had come from the East, who were not particularly blood Jews. They were, you know, they'd taken up Judaism or Talmudism, if you like. And they were like religious Jews. But the Sephardic were the blood Jews who travelled up from the Middle East through Spain. So his trail takes him back to Spain. His great-great-great-great-grandfather, apparently, was a master of fencing. And these people were held in high esteem. He would train people how to fence. He was a master at it. And he was getting quite impressed with his ancestors. And then went a little bit deeper into it, and apparently at that time, I think it was Isabel and Philip, the King of Spain, they decided that everybody should be Catholic, and if you don't renounce the religion, which is either Muslim or Jewish at the time, and turn to Christianity, then the possibility of being burnt at the stake is quite probable. So a lot of Jews did, just for the sake of it, and Muslims, turn to Christianity. But you could never really tell whether his great-great-great-great-grandfather was actually a Christian or was he really a crypto-Jew. And so they looked into it, and at one point the Spanish Inquisition was brought into it because they suspected that he was a practicing Jew or had influenced other Jews, which was quite serious. Because although this guy didn't know it, because he actually went to town on them, he couldn't believe the Spanish Inquisition could do what they did. Being religious people, he just didn't know the background to it all. But anyway, what they did, they put him in prison for 2 years, this great-great-grandfather. And after 2 years, he was still denying everything. They brought him out of prison and then decided to torture him. So they tortured him, and still this fencing master were saying, no, I'm a Catholic, and I'm a good Catholic. So once they were satisfied, they kind of put him on probation. This happens to all these people who the Inquisition pull in. And you can understand the Inquisition doing this because at the time, the Jews were infiltrating to bring down the Catholic Church, and it was their job to actually root them out and stop it. So they kept him on probation. He wasn't allowed to go to any port within 10 miles. If he went past the 10-mile mark to a port, then he would be arrested and probably burned to the stake. But he did escape, and he ended up in Holland. His nephew, however, had travelled to Spain, and he did get arrested But his great-great-grandfather went to Holland and turned out to turn back to Judaism again. So he was a crypto Jew, even though he was tortured and had 2 years imprisonment. But his nephew, his great-great-great-nephew, was burnt at the stake. There's no messing about there. And so when he got back to England, like I said, he couldn't believe it. He said, you know, how terrible can the Spanish Inquisition torture people when they're supposed to be religious? But he didn't obviously know the side of the Jews that obviously one or two of us on Radio Aryan do.
So what happened to him when he was in Holland then? Was this around about the time of Cromwell or anything like that?
Yes. Yes, that's right. Yeah. He joined up with the rest of his family out there and they all turned back to being a Jew. They changed the name again. I think his name was something like, he had a Spanish name. He changed it to David or Jacob, you know, a Jewish name. And so he was a crypto Jew. And there were many of them. Difficult. I mean, there were some genuine who changed and went Christian, but obviously difficult to find out whether they were telling the truth or not.
So he would have come over with the lot that King William of Orange brought over.
Well, yeah, because like they went to the synagogue, didn't they, in the this part of London where all the Jews gather, and that would have been the area that his ancestors in this country, they travel from, you know, Holland and originally come from Spain, and this is where he picked up this that he was either Italian or he was Spanish, but he never knew he was Jewish.
I think there was a law that was saying that if anybody engaged in usury, when they died, they weren't allowed to leave any of their proceeds to their offspring. And what happened was the proceeds went to the king. So this This meant that Jews could engage in usury and make lots of money while they were alive, but when they died, the money went to the king. So the king was going to profit. The king was going to profit from that. And there were bad kings that did things like that. There were good kings. We had good kings in Britain for 1,000 years that didn't do things like that.
And Cromwell was a bad dictator, wasn't he?
Yeah, Cromwell was a dictator, but I mean, he brought in King William of Orange, and then after King William of Orange, you know, things haven't been right as far as the monarchy is concerned because we killed a king. We had no right to kill a king, and once you kill the king, then you know, no king in his right mind is going to put his life on the line for you, knowing that you wouldn't do it for him. So, you know, I think that's why the monarchy doesn't stand up for us anymore. But when you were talking there about the this Council of 12 that ran the monetary system, and before William the Conqueror, they would have been Gentiles. They would have been Saxons, and before the Saxons, it would have been Celts. London has always been a centre from about, I think, 600 BC. That was a central place. Julius Caesar tried to invade it, and we know that these previous kings of ours, they printed coinage. They printed their own coins. They printed their own money. They had a money system, and the king was in charge of all of that. So perhaps it was when William the Conqueror came over and he brought these Jews over, maybe he replaced the people that were leading that Council of 12 with Jews. I mean, that's feasible.
Yeah.
And when you were saying about this war in Ireland, was that William the Conqueror or was that
Cromwell?
That was Cromwell. Right. So that was why he wanted the Jews, was the funding for his invasion of Ireland. And then in return for that, he had promised that these Jews would be allowed back into England.
And the Bank of England became what it was, and England slipped quickly into debt.
Yeah, England slipped quickly to debt, but all the while England was in this debt, and you know, the British people hadn't quite worked out what compound interest was and quite how it worked at the time. They were also discovering America, discovering New Zealand, Australia, conquering India, the great British Empire, and the sun will never set. And of course, they thought, well, you know, these Jews have helped with this. It's this Jewish money that they want us.
With the Freemasons, I believe. The Freemasons of Rothschilds and Milner and Rhodes, at the round table, and they're allied with the Jews as well. Obviously, Rothschild was a Jew. And so, like I said, I mean, the ordinary person of Britain who is probably suffering now today because of history, saying that, you know, that we were the problem, the white race was the problem because of all the slavery and the wiping out of the Indians, when I truly believe it were, as in World War II, the Freemasons leading these armies, telling them what to do, and wiping out whoever they could.
Well, we've also got something else here as well. And this is something that the National Socialists highlighted in one of their movies, was that the aristocracy would get itself into debt, and these Jews would be happy to lend money to the aristocracy. And then when they got themselves into debt, they would accept things like a title or deeds to land in exchange. And you can imagine the same thing happening with the king. The king wants to go to war. He hasn't got the funds to himself, like you were suggesting earlier. But he's got these rich Jews there, and they've got contacts on the continent, and they've got their hands on gold, and everything goes on this gold standard. And the Jews are happy to lend the money to the king for him to go to war. The king goes to war. He spends all that money. He can't pay the money back, so he owes the Jews a favor. And the Jews say, well, put us in charge of the money supply, and we'll wipe out the debt, and we'll also give you as many loans as you want. We'll give you as much money as you want, and all you have to do is put us in charge of the money supply.
So yeah, that's worst thing they could do. Yeah. And we said that, you look at today, the similarity with Trump and Churchill, because the Jews pulled Churchill out of debt and had him the puppet. I believe that it was the 12, Council of 12 what put Churchill in charge. And the same with Trump. Trump was in debt in Atlanta when he took up the casinos and the boxing down there. And even previous to that in New York. So, you know, they would wait and find a time where he could be useful for them. So it's just very similar to what Churchill was in my eyes.
It's an age-old trick, isn't it? Get somebody into your debt, help them out, and then you're not helping them out of mercy or charity, which is what a Christian would do, but they're helping them out because they might be able to make use of that person at some point in the future, which is the Jewish way of doing things.
Yeah, you're right. In Communism by the Back Door, I noticed the other day, there's an episode in it where I did on the 30 richest Jews in the world. And we're talking the Bronsteins over in Canada and a few others. And one of these Jews, even his family bloodline goes all the way back to Babylon, even today. And as I was just skimming through it, one caught my eye about number 10 or number 12, something like that. Guess who?
Don't know.
Jeffrey Epstein.
I wonder about this being able to trace themselves back to Babylon as well. I'm not quite sure they were able to do that because they apparently, you know, they lost everything.
Just the one, whether or not he can do it or not.
It's just obviously something good that he can brag about, basically. But how much truth there is to that, I don't know. Well, the second question here, Hitler said it was necessary for young Germans to learn boxing. Now, besides the physical benefits, what were the psychological ones? Now, I know you're into your boxing, Dennis. So, why was Hitler so keen on it? And what were the psychological benefits of learning it?
Well, obviously there's the physical benefits, but yeah, he's right about the psychological as well. First of all, boxing is known to be the hardest of all the sports. It's the single-mindedness of the one boxer. It's you and nobody else in that ring fighting for you. Two fighters come together. It isn't like it's a team thing. So obviously there's a lot of discipline in it, and it's character building. For to start with, and like I said, the self-discipline regarding the training. I mean, it's hard enough to get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning and go on a run every day, you know, but it's even harder when you've got a million in the bank, which a lot of these top boxers do. You know, they still get up and they still go out there running, pound that road at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, you must have seen the Rocky films. So there is that side to it. There's also... They, you know, Will Smith said it. I mean, not that I like the guy, but when he trained for the movie Ali, he said he would continue to train after because he was amazed at his physique. A boxer has a way of holding himself because they are confident. You know, they're trained to the max, the physical fitness. They eat well and they have to sleep as well. So all round, as I said, there is a physical aspect to it, but this psychology, which comes from being this healthy and fit guy, all comes into play. I mean, you've got the thing as well, when you're in the ring, you've got a will to win, which is often tested. I know Tyson Fury, for instance, when he fought Wilder over in America there, he was cruising, let's say, to be fair, he was cruising, but it got to the last round, and Wilder, who is renowned for his punching power, I think he's got about 40 odd fights and knocked out 39, caught him in the last minute and he hit him flush. And he didn't just hit him flush, he hit him again on the way down flush. So Tyson looked to be out and the fight looked to be over. But somewhere deep down, Tyson must have got himself together, waited patiently for the count, didn't get up straight away, because many boxers do that, and it's too early because the legs aren't ready for it. He waited for the time, and he got up and went on to dominate the rest of the round when everybody in the whole place and watching TV thought he'd been knocked out. Just incredible willpower. It's also one of the most dangerous sports. I mean, it's well known over the years, you know, the fighters have died in the ring or in comas in hospital. So, you know, all this comes into play. You train so hard, you know, and you can be beaten and your career's over and take a big beating as well. I mean, I remember there's a Welsh boxer called Johnny Owen who was undefeated many years ago and back in the 70s. And he went out to fight for the world title in South America. He was fighting a Mexican and he got knocked down a couple of times, but he got back up again. But the third time he went down, he never woke up again, which was sad because the guy was dedicated as well, and we'll still probably remember him today. You know, even the psychology of beating a guy before you get in the ring, because, I mean, Ali was a master of it. He would psych a guy out, wreck him with any means he could. And by the time that they got to the ring, he was a shell of himself and was putting out his hand. I mean, George Foreman, for instance. George Foreman was 22 years old. He was a 6'4" Mike Tyson. Everybody he fought, he knocked out within 2-3 rounds. Fighters that Ali had struggled with, like Frazier, and Frazier had beaten him, Foreman bounced across the ring like a tennis ball. This was a destructive puncher, one of the most destructive punchers boxing ever seen. And even I was worried for Ali, because Ali's now 32, he's past his best, he can't dance. But Ali's confident, and, you know, the world held their breath, and lo and behold, he took a hell of a beating just by stopping on the ropes, but then talking to Frazier, talking to Foreman, he said, "Oh, you got. You hit like a sissy," and by the round seven, he'd nothing left, and Ali knocked him out and became world champion again. So this boxing is a fascinating sport, got many features to it, and I can totally understand when Hitler says, you know, it's a great sport to learn, and a psychology part of it as well.
Well, I guess you only got one person you can rely on, and that is yourself.
Correct.
And you've also got this strategy, as you were saying, and making use of the time that you've got there before you have to stand up if you've been knocked down. The main thing I would say is just that you're having to rely on yourself and nobody else. It's all down on you, all down on your shoulders. And I guess, you know, it's good for youngsters to learn that and to be responsible, also to know that you could fight back, but you don't, because you don't want to cause damage.
Self-discipline.
That's right. So that, yeah, there are a lot of reasons there. That's interesting, that, Dennis. It's not a sport I'm really into, but I know that it was, everybody used to do it back then. as well. It was, yeah, you know, as common as cricket and football is today. Number three, why should bright people get to go to university and have it paid for by the state? How does this benefit the taxpayer who doesn't get to go to university? Well, you have to look at this in the long game. Okay, this person has had their university fees paid for them, but they are the brightest person or one of the brightest people out of that generation. And because they've had that investment in teaching them the skills that they need, they are then going to go on to earn the country massive amounts of money and their innovation. I mean, if you think about all the advances in medical science, in computer science, in all these things, they're all carried out by the brightest people in the country. And if you had the National Socialist system, they would be, you know, they wouldn't be leaving the country and taking their skills somewhere else. They would be staying within the country. And if you look at what happened in Germany, it was 10 years ahead of everywhere else. So yes, some people might have not gone to university and they were paying for other people to go to university, but their lives would have been made so much easier by it, by the technological advances and by the increase in wealth to the country. And if you've got potential there, it needs to be released, basically. And if these people can't afford to go to university, but they're really bright, that potential has all been wasted. So, you have to look at it in the long game rather than the short game. That would be my answer to that. Have you got anything else to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, again, in coming by the back door, E. Michael Jones had a good point about it. He was saying that, you know, because of this usury, students were going into debt even before they'd left university. You know, they were 20, 30, 30, because compound interest, you just can't pay it off. It's just, you're just chasing your tail. So it made some good points about that. And Gaddafi, as we know, if they didn't have it available in his country, they'd send Libyans, these students, to places like London and pay for the fees, which, you know, I'm quite sure the jacked up fees what this country charged would not apply to National Socialist Germany. I think if they saw somebody with a bit of talent, it wouldn't be a problem.
That's investment, isn't it? I mean, if you're looking at your people as they are the most valuable, and if you're looking at them like a product or whatever, you know, you make sound investments and you get a return on that investment. And if you're looking at your people as being of the most value to you, you want to invest in them, and you invest in them by teaching the brightest ones, giving them the very best education that they can have. And they're then going to increase the value of the country. So it's a sound investment. It's a waste if you're just giving it away free to, you know, people that really aren't that bright. And it's also
a terrible waste
if you're going to charge people for it like we have today. So you just end up with lots of people in debt. You end up with the standards being lowered. You know, the only way you can have it running is to fund the absolute very bright, very brightest people. And you could say afterwards, because we paid for your education, you're not allowed to leave the country and use those skills anywhere else because we invested in those skills. And people wouldn't want to do that anyway, because they would have been taught that everything that they are learning has been discovered by members of their race in the past. And if it wasn't for them discovering all this and working at it and coming out with these innovations, you wouldn't have all these tools today in order to create more for the people of the future. So you'd be teaching people that they're just a link in a chain. They're not individuals. And what they are doing is for the best of the nation, for the best of the country. So I don't think the taxpayers would be unhappy about that, because you're only talking about the very brightest and the very best. As well,
yeah, because I mean, our tax dollars go on there. A lot of things which I don't agree with, but something like that is, like you said, investment.
Yeah, I mean, today it goes on giving foreign people council houses and refugees and asylum seekers. You'd have none of that. I mean, that money would be invested in our own people, in the very brightest, and you know, they would be grateful for that and want to do the best for their country. The number four here. This is related to what we were talking about last week as well. for folks who lack the chops and desire to be intellectuals or to pursue trades such as mechanic or plumbing, etc., how should a healthy nation accommodate them? Or must they just grin and bear it, working jobs they hate until they commit suicide? And I think, you know, what you could do is you could make the workplace easier. I mean, if people are doing mundane work, boring work, then, you know, just having the radio on helps. You know, I've worked in places that have been really boring work, and just having music on, you know, it's been great. But most of the time they say that, you know, they'll take your MP3 player off you, or they'll say, no, you can't have the radio on, because they don't want to make it a better workplace.
It's funny that. Yeah, it's funny that, because where the wife used to work, closed down now, there used to be a canteen, and there used to be the radio used to play. But slowly but surely, everything started to disappear. There was no canteen at the end. There was no radios being played. It was like everything was going backwards.
Well, what was causing that then?
Management, weren't it? They were just a different outlook on things. They were looking to save money instead of looking after the workforce.
Well, this was the thing with National Socialist Germany. It was about looking after the workforce. They were the first people to bring Clean Air Act. Yeah, they brought in the canteens. They brought in the Strength Through Joy cruises, holidays for people, reduced prices to see the high arts, opera, orchestras, ballet, things like that. So what you would do is you would make the workplace a more enjoyable place to be, I guess. And go on.
You get people who criticise and say it's not true. A lot of this, you know, they'll criticise the economic miracle, but they'll also criticise the National Socialists. You know, they won't agree that things were better and all this kind of carry on. But I've got a newspaper cutting from that era, from New Zealand. And they went over to Germany, obviously, to inspect what was going on, and they admitted it's the best they'd ever seen in the world. So it wasn't a lie.
No, there's plenty of records of people that went over there and were amazed by it. I think Colin Jordan was one of them. He went to Germany, saw how much better it was than Britain, and then he was a committed National Socialist for the rest of his life. Yeah. But, what the National Socialists did, they said, well, we don't want unemployed people. If everybody wants to work. I mean, you can't have a sense of worth, self-worth, if you're not actually contributing in some way. So they did provide work for people. And so if you've got this character like the one that's being described here, he hasn't got a trade, musty, grin and bear it. Well, he could have gone out and done some physical work, like building roads, building infrastructure. And, you know, 20 years later, he could be driving along and I helped build this bridge, you know, or I helped build this building or this infrastructure, telephone lines or what have you. So he got a sense of self-satisfaction there. He can see something that he contributed to, even though it would be hard work. And if it is hard work and it's outdoors or whatever, then you're getting all the physical fitness you need. You think of all the office workers that pay out all this money to go, you know, running on a treadmill and riding a cycle in the gym. You're getting paid to keep yourself fit and healthy by working outside. So you've got different ways of looking at work as well. And I think the National Socialists, they had the right idea about work and how you can find fulfillment in the work that you do. And that's all they were trying to teach the Jews, was to work, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, they all pulled together. You had this feeling of the whole country's all pulling in the right direction, where over here, it's like individually, you know, some are doing all right, a lot of struggling, but there's no unity to it all. It's just an individual, if you like. It's still based on greed, if you like.
Yeah, and individual greed. It's much better when you've got a whole team and you're all pulling in the same direction, and you know that what you're doing is going to be of benefit to you and the people around you in some way. So the whole idea of work was looked at differently back then, and I would suggest that's how a healthy nation accommodates the people that don't have these skills. And again, they must have something that they're that they are good at, something that they enjoy doing. I mean, what people enjoy doing tends to be what they become good at. And if you are good at something, then, you know, you tend to enjoy doing it as well. It's just finding what that is for people. You know,
well, one of the problems as well over here, I don't think they have the same problem in Germany, is it's now in Britain, the prison system is running like, and the rest of the world as well, is based on the American system, which is, for every prisoner, what they throw in prison, whether it be for smoking cannabis or whatever, they'll give them a longer sentence there because every prisoner can bring up to $50,000. It's a privately run industry. And so there's no real care about the prisoner after he's left prison because most of them struggle to get a job. If you've been put in prison for attempted murder, you're hardly going to get a job, especially with the internet today. They'll, you know, soon find out. And so it's a vicious circle, and they go back into prison again. And they don't mind that, the government, because it's another 50,000 or another £50,000. Like. So I don't think Germany had that problem because crime dropped because everybody was quite happy and, you know, wealthy and we're doing fine.
Another problem with that is also that it's using work as a punishment, and it's getting you to look at work and labour as if it's some form of punishment rather than, you know, what we're created to do. We are created
to
work and contribute.
People work today, they work all week, sorry Sven, they work all week and they can't afford an holiday.
Yeah, and obviously you need to have enough money left over to improve your life as well. You don't want to be paying out 3/4 of your money just on the roof over your head.
Yeah.
And again, it's
more out there. Yeah.
And again, that's caused by the immigration and the lack of enough houses. And we've got more than enough houses. We're not producing enough people to replace ourselves. So that answers those four questions. And I would like to finish the Nazi Sozi this week. We've got just a couple more sections to do on it. And I just remind people, this was the book that was written by Joseph Goebbels, I think 1926 or something like that, before the National Socialists took power. And it's outlining National Socialism to a young novice, a young man who's asking an older National Socialist about what it is that they believe in. And the section I've got here to begin with is war and pacifism. And he says, what we've given today, is that peace? Is it peace when millions are out in the streets, out of work, without food? Is it peace when young children have to starve to death, when our people are reduced to beggary, when this once thriving Germany of ours is being made to resemble a desert? What we've experienced since 1918 has been a war without end, and this war is growing more vicious and brutal with each passing day. Have a look at the quotations of the International Stock Exchange. Those are the war reports from the headquarters of the economic war. And see, German workers and their families are the dead and the dying of that war. That is your peace. It's the peace of the graveyard. Your order is the rigid order of death. No, indeed, good friend, we don't want that. We will call to arms in opposition to it. We will call upon the people to rid themselves of their tormentors and to break the chains that the Jews have put upon us. So what he's saying there is, you know, this, what we are calling peace is not actually how man should be living. And I think that applies just as well to today, where you've got people with food banks, you've got people out of work, people that can't afford a roof over their head, people that are getting into debt, plus you've got all the immorality, all the degenerate ideas that are pushed upon us. We're in a constant battle to just to survive, a lot of people.
And so this is one of the richest countries in the world.
Yeah,
so where's all the money going?
Yeah, great. The whole system is back to front. So they were looking at it that, and also they were looking at it that the war had not stopped. It was supposed to have stopped in 1918, but they were in the same condition 10 years later that they were at the end of the war, in a worse condition with the blockades and the starvation, and the massive inflation in the money supply. So they were saying that it's supposed to be peace, but it's like the war has continued.
It's a struggle, isn't it, every day.
Well, and it was similar at the end of World War II, wasn't it? The war was supposed to be over.
Exactly.
Yet more of them died after the war was over than during the war, during all the years of the war put together.
Yeah.
And he says, only the fight for true peace can lead beyond the death of a people and its nation. The eternal principle of nature is not justice, it's strength. And that is why we want to toughen our nation so that it may survive in the battle of life. Pacifism does not ensure peace. On the contrary, history shows us that those peoples and nations that were no longer ready and willing to defend their existence, with force if necessary, have always come to a humiliating end. We will protect our people from that fate. They shall grow strong in will and spirit. They shall not be humiliated like a pariah among the nations. And I'll just stop there because, you know, you've got all these people that say, well, we want to get rid of our arms. We want to get rid of our nuclear weapons. We want to get rid of all these weapons of war. If you don't have them, then you've got nothing to defend yourself with. Then that's it. You're done for. And I think this ties in with this boxing as well, Dennis. You know, like just as an individual, got to learn how to defend yourself and defend your existence. Because if you don't know how to defend yourself, yeah, you could just be taken out. And it's the same with the nation. They weren't warmongers. They weren't saying, you know, we need to be like this because we're going to go out and conquer the world. But we need to have the strongest defense that we can possibly have. And, you know, it's the same principle that Donald Trump operates on.
He came out with a line in Hitler about that. He said, when does a fox ever pass an unguarded chicken hut?
Good to see him
Which
using
that. Which is what Germany was at the time.
Good to see him using that same analogy, isn't it?
And yeah.
I think Hitler's used that as well, isn't he? The fox and the chicken. Trump That's uses right. a lot of good analogies. That one.
No, I mean, Hitler said that, I think. I didn't know Trump had said it.
No, I thought you were saying Trump had said it. Yeah, I know Hitler said it. Trump says about the snake, doesn't he? About the woman taking the snake home and then the snake biting her.
That's the one, yeah. That's Trump's one, yeah.
Yeah, I think he might have mentioned the frog and the scorpion as well. Mm. The hen and the fox and the chicken. He says, we want our rights, and these rights are liberty, bread, and living space. If we are denied these rights, we will fight for them. This fight for liberty, bread, and living space is everybody's business, the highest citizen as well as the lowliest. It's a matter for the entire nation. The united power of 80 million Germans determined to survive will go a longer way towards ensuring peace than any lie about human rights. Human rights haven't brought us any peace, have they? They've just brought us discord in promoting sodomy around the world.
I don't believe I've got any human rights, being a National Socialist. Everybody else has.
Well, you never get people that are going to fight for rights. People fight for their people. They fight for flesh and blood, not abstract ideas. And finally, talking here about living space, it's actually talking about Lebensraum. And it's got an explanation of that here. Lebensraum, translated as living space, was perhaps the most misunderstood German slogan during World War II. This term was pounced upon by British as well as Soviet propagandists and became an effective tool for motivating the troops for their campaign of terror against Germany. The author is actually referring to the harsh terms of the Versailles Treaty, which he mentions on page 12. Germany, by the dictates of the treaty, had a large amount of its territory taken away. By far the most painful and portentous loss was that of the Posen area, West Prussia, and Danzig, the Polish corridor, which chopped Germany in two and put the Polish border just 100 miles from Berlin. Besides the areas in Europe, vast German territories in Africa, Asia, and the Pacific Ocean were likewise taken away. The millions of German residents in these former German administrative areas, furthermore, were subjected to harsh treatment by the new governments. Also, Germany suffered 1 million 9,000, I can't even make this out, but I think 19 million military deaths in World War One, and 763,000 more died as a result of the starvation blockade, which was even extended after 1918. To envisage what psychological effects these losses had on the German nation, we need only recall the costly and frantic military efforts undertaken by Great Britain just to recover the Falkland Islands from Argentina in 1982. Scarcely 2,000 inhabitants were involved. So you can draw an analogy between the Falkland Islands, that tiny little bit that was taken from Britain, and these huge chunks that were taken away from Germany. So that's why Hitler was talking about Lebensraum, living space, living room. They wanted this space back for their people to live in, because it had been taken away from them.
Took all the colonies as well.
Yeah, you know, they had no colonies left. That's why he was saying, because we've lost our colonies, you know, it's not unreasonable to suggest that the so some areas in Russia that are not very well populated have no modern trappings of civilization. Let the Germans take them over. And we'll build housing there. We'll turn the land into farmland, and we'll benefit from it. And the Russians will benefit from it too.
Everybody wins.
Yeah. Everybody would have won. The Nordics, I mean, they went into Russia, they went into Poland, they went into lots of places. They were invited in just so that they could bring law and order and farming technology, agricultural ideas, and all these things, and raise the living standards of the people that were living there. That's why the aristocracy in Russia were Nordic, and in parts of southern Europe as well. And they were invited there to do that, because it was of benefit to them.
A huge, huge amount of land. I mean, you wouldn't even feel it, would they, Russia?
No. I mean, it's terrible the way this Lebensraum is presented. It's presented as if Hitler wanted to go out and conquer the world, when he was just talking about, look, we need the space for the growth that there's going to be in German population. And if you look, Britain went out and conquered America. And what was the point of that? Well, it was because we know that we're going to keep increasing in population, and we have to conquer new lands and get them ready for the next population. You know, the contraception has messed all of that up, obviously, in the last century. But that was the point of going to these countries. It wasn't some kind of bloodlust or wanting to get rid of the natives that were there. It was simply about providing for our descendants. Building up a country.
I've noticed, by the way, I watched a program on YouTube the other day about Ireland, and they were saying new technology, new DNA. Now, the original Irish now were African. Surprise, surprise. And you go on YouTube now, and they're in full flow now, because they got rid of everybody who knew the game. And, you know, you go on YouTube now, and they're pushing absolutely everything, climate change, everything. And when you go around the internet, you see all these videos which won't play. And these are all the videos which YouTube wiped out, you know, made for education purposes. And they're just going on full pelt now, because there's nobody on YouTube really to question anything. I saw somebody the other day saying how wonderful these programs are. It was just all propaganda.
Total brainwashing. But it's not working, is it? There's more and more people that are waking up to it.
Yeah. But still a lot are unaware, I think.
When people see these blank videos where a video used to be on websites,
they're everywhere. You know,
they're going to be, well, what's this then? It's obviously censorship, isn't it?
Boat burning.
I've got a final quote here from the book, Germany's Freedom. And what will be the end result of all this? The end result will be the freedom of the German people on German soil. This freedom will ensure bread and life for every working German. It bears within itself those moral and spiritual strengths with which we will shape this new country. We want to achieve more by means of this freedom than just a new system. We want to achieve the new man who, within the conditions of the better worldview that we will have attained, can progress into the future. The future will be ours, or it will not be at all. Liberalism will die, so that socialism may live. Marxism will die so that nationalism may live. And then we will shape the new Germany, the nationalistic socialist Third Reich. And that's what they set about to do. That's very true as well. You know, either it's like that or it will not be at all. And what's happening now is the not be at all, isn't it? It's the future's just disappearing before our very eyes.
When in America, a mother wants to castrate her 7-year-old son because he thinks he's a girl, and the whole system, the judges and everybody is behind the mother, it's a problem. Because that will come to Britain one day.
Well, just to finish on a positive note, there are lots and lots of people that are saying that this transitioning thing was all totally wrong and it hasn't helped them and they want to detransition. There's hundreds of them. There's so many of them that there's a new charity started up, and that's just in Britain for people that are detransitioning.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, we've got to finish on a positive note here, Dennis. We can't leave everyone depressed. Well, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you. ¶¶